Okay, hi there. Oh, you can't hear me. Okay. Let's try volume. How's that? Is that better? Now you can hear me. That's good. Okay, questions before we go back to where we were? Announcements, Talia? No, you're fine. Okay. Okay, then we will go back to the initial tasks of marriage. This will be a fun one when you go home. If you go home this week, next week, sometime, or you're talking one of those several a day cell phone conversations with your parents, ask them how they did at these various tasks, what kinds of issues they may have run into. So, we were talking about number four, I believe, and I think several points had been made during the course of the discussion on Monday. And one of the points is that while these are ones that tasks that Wallerstein identified by interviewing married couples, they are related to and perhaps quite similar to tasks that you're going to have to take care of when you begin a relationship, when you cohabit, perhaps when you get engaged. Some of the same things are going to happen. My point that I was stressing was that each of those steps changes the nature of the psychological relationship within the couple, because it changes the sense of commitment. It may change the assumptions about what comes next, what's the trajectory here. So even though a couple have lived together and have tackled these tasks, when they get married, they may have to renegotiate them. So the fact of marriage, because it's a public commitment and it ties you legally, financially, in ways that you were not tied before, has symbolic meaning for each person in the couple. And I think I was on the cynical and depressing point when we ended that people court. They court even while they're cohabiting. They treat each other as if they were trying to seduce them or convince them to marry. And once the marriage has happened, that goal has been reached, then people can change from the courting to the settling down and being married phase. And that may imply for one or both partners that there are changes in what's expected now. I don't have to treat you so thoughtfully now that I've married you. Now, there are expectations that change. And those expectations are likely to be related to your experience in your family of origin. So marriage changes not only the legal and financial obligations within the couple, it may change the expectations and the assumptions. Okay, now I can be me more fully because you've committed yourself to me, and now it's okay if I do things a little bit differently. And that, I don't want that to sound like a manipulative, devious, deceptive tack that people are taking. It's quite unconscious and it's quite real. The shift is quite real, but it's not something that we intend typically to do unless we're really out to deceive and to defraud. But people's attitudes subtly change, and it makes it necessary to go back to some of these tasks and renegotiate them. So we were talking about number four, establishing marriage as a zone of safety and nurturance. And while all of these might seem obvious, I think they deserve some attention. And one of the issues about making the marriage, the relationship, as a safe zone has a parallel in what happens when infants or toddlers who are attached to a parent are able, because of that attachment, to go out and explore the world. So for early childhood educators, this is a familiar scene. We know that children who are not closely attached and securely attached with a parent or caregiver have difficulty exploring the world because they're fearful, they're anxious. So as they start to move away from the person who's taking care of them, they start to get anxious and they come back. They need to check on the person. Now they pick up their cell phone and call every few hours to make sure mom is there or dad is there or the caregiver is there. And that process of being anxious keeps the child from being able to explore the environment until the child has established the security and confidence that the caregiver is going to be there, that you can trust that. And as the toddler learns to do that, then gradually, if there's a secure attachment, the kid can use that. We call it a secure base. Okay, I've got this secure base over there. I don't need to worry about it. But having it behind me allows me to go out and take some risks and explore the world and expand my horizons. Without a secure attachment, people have difficulty learning and exploring the world that they're in. That doesn't stop in toddlerhood. It's also true here. It's true in marriage. Being in a good relationship that you don't have to worry about, that you can trust, that's secure, that's nurturing, allows you to take risks and to explore your capabilities in the world. That's a very little studied aspect of marriage and close relationships. But it's anecdotally a very common experience that people get into a relationship that is secure. And in this case, now we have the marriage. It's secure. We trust each other. We're working to make sure that we know we can depend on each other. And that not only strengthens the relationship, but it allows both partners to grow. It allows both partners to grow, to develop, to continue to extend themselves. It gives you the security to take some risks because you know you have the support of your partner. It's a very important part of a good relationship. And it's very difficult for some couples to do that. Some couples get into the situation where they got married, that's great, now I love you, you're perfect, don't ever change. And the marriage then becomes focused on staying the same and not exploring, not moving out, not stretching your capabilities, because that threatens the relationship. So the relationship is not a source of nurturance if you're going to continue to develop. Any kind of change threatens the relationship. And that's a relationship that is not good for people. So in this task, what Wallerstein is referring to is not just being able to be secure that your partner is there and will nurture you and take care of you, and it's safe in the relationship, but the relationship also provides a secure base for you to continue to grow and know that your partner encourages that and that your partner will also continue to grow, to develop new viewpoints, to explore new skills, to take some risks interpersonally because the relationship is secure. One of the ways that you can look at a relationship is whether people are growing as individuals in it. And if they're stuck at the same point and they're resisting each other's change, it's not a healthy relationship. I remember talking with one couple who were in the process of getting a divorce after struggling for a number of years. They thought about it. They talked about it. They did some counseling. and eventually decided that they would separate. And the conversation was a fascinating conversation as they made that decision and came to terms with it. And they divorced well, but the husband in this couple had continued to change his interests. He continued to explore new things. He was very open to things that came along. And he kept encouraging his wife to explore those with him. So he was very good at creating fun and interest for the couple. But over the course of 10 or 15 years, she began to resist those. And she would say, "You go ahead. You do that. I don't really enjoy it." And she began to pull back from things that they had explored together. And he continued. And they did more and more things separately because she didn't want to participate in anything new. And the way she represented that was the way he represented it. The way she represented it was that I can't get involved in new things. I can just barely deal with what I have. I don't like new things. I'm like a cat. I don't want my space invaded. I don't want my mind invaded. I don't want anything new. And I have my routines, and that's what I want. And they continued to explore that. And he was very proud of the fact that he was no longer the person he was when they had gotten married, that he had continued, he thought, to become more interesting. And she agreed with that. She just didn't want him to do it. And she finally kind of summed it up. She said, "I'm a very anxious and I'm a person without a lot of confidence, and I married him because he's the rock. He's always dependable and solid. And I did not want him to change. If he changes, then I have to change, and I'm not sure I can depend on him." So she put it right out on the table. The marriage was based on her need for him to stay exactly as he was, predictable, no vulnerability. And he was apparently one of those nice guys when they got married at 30 or so that, you know, he didn't know himself. From a hole in the ground. He didn't express emotions. He didn't know how to deal with them. He was very predictable because he was very solidly defended and didn't know what to do. And as he'd grown emotionally and personally, he had become able to cry and weepy about children and sick cats and things like that. And this made her very anxious. And she had finally started resisting everything new and wanted him to go back to being the way he was when he was 30. And so they split. It was okay for them, I think. I think it was given her inability to be secure in the relationship, I think it was certainly unreasonable for her to expect him not to change, and certainly unreasonable for him to keep trying to get her to change. He made it very safe for her to change, apparently, but she couldn't do it. So they split. They had not accomplished that. They had established it fairly well at the beginning, but it wasn't for the long term. Number four. Okay, eventually, number five that couples stumble across is sometimes, not always, but sometimes couples want to have children. And then you begin to take on a new task, very complex task, and a lot of stress. And the problem when you do that, and we'll talk about that in more detail when we look at Galinsky a bit later today, the problem when you do that is that people often get so involved in the parenting and in the relationship with the child or children that they forget to maintain space for the couple relationship. And this is not one that often, that always comes up at the beginning, because people delay facing it until they have children. But it is a general problem in the early phases of marriage if you begin to have children. And it's expanding the relation to make room for children, which also includes expanding the relationship and the view of each other to make room for pregnancy. We rarely marry people who are 7 or 8 months pregnant. Sometimes we do, but usually we've been cohabiting in the, anyway, and we know they're pregnant. What happens is that when people get married, most of us in first marriages haven't had much experience with pregnancy, and part of what you have to do as a couple is to accommodate and allow for and eventually cherish the changes that take place through pregnancy, and adapt your relationship, adapt your sexual relationship to take into account morning sickness, nausea, feeling like a blob, eventually being grumpy and impatient because it's July in the middle of the summer and you're 7 months pregnant and you just want this over. And that can stress the couple relationship. It takes a good deal of accommodation in the relationship to enjoy those phases of it. And they are enjoyable. They're fun, particularly if people both want to have a child. Then it becomes something that you focus on. Oh, good, let's see how your body's changed this week and how you're feeling about that. And let me help you with your morning sickness. I'll run out and get soda crackers or intravenous nourishment, since you can't keep anything down. It becomes a joint activity for the couple if they're coping with it well. If it doesn't become a joint activity, if the pregnancy doesn't become a joint activity, then the couple is not making the relationship changes that they need to make it okay and safe and fun to be pregnant and to have a child. So if they don't do that during the pregnancy, if they don't make those accommodations, then having a child is going to be difficult for them, because there are more accommodations that need to be made when you put a third person in there. Six, establishing a relationship that's fun and interesting. I'm always struck when I talk about this one by something that Mrs. Hubble said. You all know the Hubble telescope? Hubble telescope? The Hubble telescope is named for the astronomer who designed it. He was a professor at Princeton for many, many years. I think he may have just recently died. Don't quote me. Especially if you're alive, Edwin. I remember an interview with his wife when they were both approaching 70, and part of the video that I was watching was about his life, and he was rock climbing in his late 60s with his graduate students, and they were interviewing his wife about what it was like to be married to this man, and her comment was, I have enjoyed every minute of it. He's interesting and fun and full of surprises, and the one thing that I can always count on is that no matter what's going on in our life, he will surprise me some way, and it'll be a positive way. But he's an amazingly creative, interesting man, so I can't imagine having spent my life with anybody else, because nobody else would be as interesting as this man was. Kind of a nice epitaph, if he's dead, but kind of a nice thing to be able to say about your spouse, and a very nice component of the relationship if you can enjoy that. And if both people can be interesting to each other, and that's one of the reasons to keep developing. So going back to four, if the marriage or the relationship is a safe and nurturing place that allows you to grow, it's much more likely that you will have new things to bring into the relationship that will keep you interesting. If you're not learning anything, if you're not developing and you stay the same, eventually most people are going to get bored to tears with you, including your spouse. And you don't want that to happen. And maintaining an idealized view, incorporating reality. This is the delusion part. It's a little bit of healthy delusion that says, she was the most beautiful woman in the world when I married her, and she has spent the last 42 years becoming more beautiful. I can't imagine anybody who could be a better spouse. Those are delusions. It's just plain and simple. They're delusions, and they're very healthy delusions, and if couples have them, you can incorporate the reality into your view that this is the most interesting, fascinating person in the whole world. The relationship is likely to last. The relationship is likely to last. Okay. Any questions about any of those?
Do you think that delusion can go from being healthy to unhealthy?
If yes, I think that delusions can be unhealthy if they become too divorced from reality, which is why she tagged the incorporating reality in there, so that it doesn't get caught up in you were the most beautiful person in the world, and I still think you are, and therefore I'm going to ignore any of the signs of aging. I'm going to deny that you have any slowing up, even though you're 65 years old. I'm going to deny any changes in you. That is not incorporating the reality. And then the relationship can become unhealthy because the delusion leads you to ignore the reality of your partner, and it's important to stay in touch with the reality of the partner's feelings and the partner's needs. I just had an experience running into that one that I hadn't connected to this, but a couple who've been having some difficulty in their relationship because the wife is going through menopause, and it's being a rough menopause, fairly rough menopause. It's lasted, you know, hot flashes and night sweats and some discomfort for 3 or 4 years, and that's, you know, fairly significant. And her husband is maintaining the delusion that she's not going through menopause. So he's doing two things. One is no empathy at all. And two, he's looking for serious medical problems that are the cause of what are fairly typical menopausal changes. So his delusion that she's perfect is divorced from the reality that she's going through menopause, and he wants to reverse these changes. He wants them to go away and have her go back to being premenopausal. And that's not going to happen. She is menopausal, and she will change. And he can keep his idealized view, but he can't keep her premenopausal. It's not going to happen. So his delusion is becoming unhealthy. He's invested in denying the reality of it. And you can speculate about why. I think probably the reality of his own aging is more frightening to him. So if she doesn't change, then he doesn't have to change. Other questions about any of these? Okay, so you get through these, and then you stay married for 50 years, 60 years. And along comes Francine Klagsburn, and she wrote a book in 85, published it in 85, on staying together in an age of divorce. And what she did to prepare for this book was to study couples who were happily married over a long period of time. And so she got people to nominate happy couples who'd been married. I think the limit for her was at least 25 years. And she went out and interviewed a bunch of them and boiled down what is it that allows a couple to stay together for as long as possible. And you'll see the overlap. Some of these couples had been married 55 or 60 years. They were elderly people. And this is what she boiled it down to from their responses. The ability to change and tolerate change. Again, making it a safe place to continue to develop. An ability to live with what you can't change. Some of you are familiar with the Serenity Prayer. Give me the... I don't know. Some of you know it. I just blocked on it. Give me the courage to change the things that need to be changed, and the patience to endure the things that can't be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference. Something like that. I paraphrased it. And what she's suggesting is that couples who are able to stay together happily for a long period of time deal with the changes, and they also learn to live with the things that can't be changed. Some things can't be changed. They assume that the relationship is permanent. And they sometimes have very colorful ways of describing that, such as, and she quotes some of them, I can paraphrase them and add a few that I've heard over the years. I married him till death do us part. And I trust him to behave in such a way that I don't have to kill him. He can't divorce me. He'll have to kill me. Things like that. Or we assumed that we were going to get married forever because we can't afford a divorce. And so we're stuck with each other. We might as well enjoy it. What the assumption of permanence does for the couple is commit them to working out their problems. So they don't look at a problem in the way Gottman in your reading describes. Some couples look at problems and conflict and start figuring out how to get out of it, how to get away from it. These couples look at the problem and say, well, if we're going to stay together for the next 30 or 40 years, we'd better work this out. So they confront the issues because they assume their relationship is more important than any issue they could face, and it's permanent. They trust each other. They have proven that they are dependable. Trust is earned. Trust is earned by daily being trustworthy. And couples who stay together for a long period of time do not have mistrust. If you read the Dear Abby or Dear Annie column, you'll see regularly that one of the issues that comes up is people are trying to decide whether to stay in a relationship, and the issue is that trust has been broken. And often the advice is you have to decide whether you can regain that trust. So if you blow it as a partner, if you make a huge mistake, if you're in danger of destroying the relationship, one of the tasks that you face is after you've been caught and you've acknowledged it and you've apologized, then you have to be a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout, trustworthy for as long as it takes for the other person to trust you again. Your parents put you through this, right? You made a big mistake. You stayed out too late, you wrecked the car, you lied, whatever it was you did, and they said, you have broken our trust, you will have to earn it back. And it surprised you that they didn't trust you the next week. And they were very clear. You know, it took a year. It took months or a year or a couple of years before they were able to fully trust you again, and some of you had parents who reminded you of that. We're not ready to trust you fully yet. And they reminded you. In a couple relationship, the same thing happens. And for couples, for example, when infidelity has been the problem, it may be 5 to 10 years before a partner is fully ready both to trust and to forgive. If you assume the relationship is permanent, you go through that. If you don't, then instead of living with the mistrust and the suspicion, you bail. These couples that Klagsburn interviewed did not have perfect marriages. They hadn't been way up there at the 99th percentile of happiness with each other for 25 to 50 years. That's not the point. The point is that they had ways of dealing with the problems that all couples face. They had ways of dealing with them that were based on these characteristics. They did trust each other, and they didn't do anything that was so bad that the other person couldn't develop that trusting relationship again. They had a balance of dependencies. They didn't assume that they were the same, and they were able to take care of their responsibilities differently. And they felt equal. That was the important thing for these couples. They felt, okay, I depend on her for this, that, and the other thing. I'm not very good at those things. And she would say, I depend on him for this, this, and the other thing. And those dependencies were nicely balanced. Nobody had to be perfect. They had learned to lean on each other and to be what we call interdependent. Interdependence is being able to trust each other, not having to be perfect, not having to be completely autonomous and independent, but being able to depend on each other so that as a couple you get everything done. They enjoyed each other. These were people who laughed. They smiled. They looked forward to being with each other. They missed each other when they were gone. They kept in touch if they were separated. And they just liked being with each other. And as they got older, one of the things that had happened was that they would start to say things like, well, you know, we got invited to a party Saturday night, but, well, you can't do everything. And we knew it would be smoky and people would be drinking too much. And I'd really much rather sit home and talk to my wife than go to a party. These are people who really liked to be together. I think I shared with you what my mother's 96-year-old cousin said about his long-term marriage. His wife died about 5 years ago. He said they just had a great time together. They traveled together. They did a lot of stuff together. And said, he said, she was my best buddy. If I wanted to go fishing, she went fishing, and we enjoyed each other's company. We traveled together. Said she was always good company, and that kept them going till death did them part temporarily, in his view. A shared history. Erikson describes the notion of intimacy as involving creating shared identity. That you create an identity for each person. Each person creates a separate identity during early adulthood, adolescence and early adulthood. But then when you create a partnership, you put those identities together and you create the shared identity, which is, here's one of them, here's the other one, and then as they create the sense of intimacy, they have this part that overlaps. That's the shared identity as a couple. And Erikson says what that represents is that each person has within his or her identity a portion of that being defined as, I am so-and-so's spouse or partner. Okay. And that is part of who I am. Okay. So in my case of the, I identify myself, part of my identity is as Laurie's husband. And part of her identity is as Larry's wife. And so when you talk to people about who you are, you include being a member of the couple. And as you begin to do that, you establish the sense of intimacy. You feel that you're part of a couple. And that's the part that you want to continue. And it becomes based on the shared history. You've done things together. You've created memories together. you talk about those memories, and they become cherished. They are the stories you tell your children and grandchildren. They're the stories you tell other people that you meet. Let me tell you how we met. Let me tell you about our 25th anniversary party. And the couple have the shared history, and that's very important to them. If people aren't developing that, then you question whether there is intimacy, whether they're really creating a coupleness that is going to keep them together. And the eighth, just all the couples said, well, it's just luck. You know, I didn't know anything when I proposed to her when I was 20. I just knew she was cute and I was supposed to get married. And, you know, fortunately, she grew me up and I guess I was pretty lucky. Or couples will say, we're fortunate that nothing really bad has ever happened, anything that we couldn't overcome together. And that's just luck. And there's this little bit in most of the couples of just recognizing that they don't have a formula they can give anybody else. They can't tell other people how to do it. They can tell people how they did it. And part of it is just luck. Just being with the right person in the right place at the right time. And it's just luck. And I think it's neat that they can accept that. That it's not what they did entirely. It's not what the partner did entirely. There's a little bit of that, and then there's luck. Just lucky, I guess. And that's what they say. We're just lucky. Can't explain it. Wouldn't have expected it. There it is. Okay. Questions about those? Ask your grandparents, if you can, about their relationships. Ask your parents if they're still happily married. See how it fits for them. Questions or observations or examples? Okay, let's take a different look. You have a reading by Carrere and Gottman on predicting divorce, predicting the future of marriages. And it's an article that is from a chapter in a book on divorce in which John Gottman and one of his major collaborators, Sybil Carrere, talk about the research that they have done, Gottman has done for years and years and years at University of Washington in Seattle in the Love Lab. Gottman was a professor who taught, he's retired now, but very active retirement, he's no longer teaching. Gottman studied couples. He was a couples therapist and a family therapist and has spent the last 30 or 40 years looking at couples, trying to figure out what it is that drives relationships and pulls people together and drives them apart. He's written a number of books about that. If you're in 65, anybody in 65, you're probably using his book on the secrets of effective relationships or marriages or something like that, which is a nice review of his work. Gottman's an expert. I think he's on his third marriage. So he may be not the best husband in the world, but he's a very fine researcher. And what he's focused on is trying to make studying the couple relationship a science. Let's see if we can really focus it and figure out, instead of people like Shelton talking about their anecdotes of people that they know, let's see if we can actually make this a science. And that's what he's done a very successful job of. Among other things, he's had couples come into an apartment and live with the recorder on, live microphones, 24 hours a day, week at a time, and study the interactions that go on among them with some opportunity for privacy. He's also developed a technique where he has couples talk to each other about important conflicts that they have, the things that they disagree on. And in that kind of research, he has them face each other, and then each is on camera, so he can put the couple on split screen, and he records what they say, and he also records heart rate, galvanic skin response, blood pressure, muscle tension, those sorts of things. And he looks at what happens when they get into areas of conflict to talk about. He also then looks at what they, how they talk about each other and about the conflict, and does silly little things like count the number of positive things they say about each other and the number of negative things. And he's watched couples who are in the process of getting married. He's watched couples dating, and he's watched long-term couples, both divorcing and non-divorcing couples. And with a guy named Christensen, he also studied abusive couples, couples who were really, my favorite couple was the one Christensen called the Viper. And what was his, he was the Viper, she was something else. Anyway, they hospitalized each other on a regular basis, broken back, deep knife, you know, kitchen disemboweling, that kind of stuff. But they stayed together. You have to kind of wonder. But he was interested in couples like that. How do they talk to each other? And one of the things that he looked at was how people deal with emotions when they're talking with their partner, and what happens to each person in the couple, and when do things start to get uncomfortable for them. And can you, from how they talk and how they talk about each other, how they talk to each other, can you predict whether they're going to stay together or get divorced? And one of his books is Predicting Divorce, and in it he demonstrates that you can predict divorce for couples, and he's done it with greater accuracy than anybody else has ever done it. So he can study the couple for an hour and put a prediction in the computer, and 5-10 years later his prediction is right 90 some percent of the time. It's kind of scary to think that we could do that. In looking at the marriage partners, he describes 5 different kinds of marriages. That not all marriages are wonderfully compatible. There are 3 different kinds he calls stable. These are people who don't get divorced. And they are volatile. And volatile marriages are the ones where people yell and scream and have fights, and everybody knows them because you live down the hall from them, and they're noisy, and they call each other names, and they're volatile. Some people call them the operatic marriage. Yeah. Lots of excitement and lots of conflict. And they're stable because the couples are respectful of each other, even while they're calling each other names. And they often use the volatility, as we've talked about before, they use that volatility to put heat and passion into the relationship. And after they've had a fight, they go to bed, they make up, they have the best sex of the month, and then they're fine. And they typically resolve their conflicts by doing exciting and interesting things, like having sex. So these are couples where the stable pattern is conflict, but it's resolved. They may have the same fight over and over again for 30 years, but one of the reasons they have the fight is not because it's really serious, but because they need to get excited so they can have good sex. and that keeps them together. The second kind is validating. Those are the marriages you want. The validating marriage is one where two people really do respect and love each other, and they're working to grow and to validate each other, and the marriage convinces you that there's more and more respect developing between these two people. And if you watch them while you're interviewing them, or while he's interviewing them, taping them, they talk very positively about each other. They're very happy with each other. They may have conflicts, but they resolve them fairly easily, and the respect continues to build. Conflict-avoiding marriages are the ones where people stay together just by avoiding all conflict. So there's a lot of compromise, a lot of burying of thoughts and feelings. These are often the couples who aren't really very happy, but they're not going to get divorced. They have assumed that they are married forever, and they often will say, this is the way marriages always get. They're wrong, of course, but it helps them stay in the marriage because they say, well, we just don't talk about it. We just don't deal with that. And when you interview them about things that are conflictful for them, they have each independently identified things that they disagree on or that are a problem. So you have them talk about how they spend money or how they raise the kids or how whatever. And they start talking about it, and you tell them to talk about it. Okay, now I want you to spend 10 minutes on this conflict and see if you can resolve it. And they spend about 30 seconds talking about it, and then they're off somewhere else. Yeah. They're avoiding it. And that's the way they stay together. They never deal with the important issues. And then that's fine, if you want a stable marriage. Then there are the two unstable marriages, and these people are typically mismatched in how they deal with each other. And what has happened for them in the relationship is that there's a fair amount of hostility. And in the hostile relationships, they don't really like each other. And they treat each other in ways that may be full of conflict. And they are not nice. And they don't say positive things to each other. They say a lot of negative things to and about each other. So they're hostile. And then there are the others are the hostile detached. Those people have never really come together. For some reason they're together. They may even be married, but they really don't like each other. But they don't make a big deal out of it. They're detached from each other. So they don't really say a lot about each other when they talk about the relationship. But when they're forced to talk about the relationship or to each other, it tends to be largely negative, but not in an engaged way. So they talk about each other, often using the third person. So you can be in the room and talk to your partner and refer to her as she. Or the mister. Not you. Not second person, but third person. Like, this person isn't even really there. You're just talking about him or her. And that's a sign of being detached. So those are the different types. What happens that begins to drive people apart? Why do those hostile marriages fall apart? And what's the internal process in this relationship? And this is what Gottman has done really, really well by looking at what happens when people have conflict and talking with them, having them review for him what has happened in a conflict situation. So you had an argument Saturday afternoon, and individually he will ask each person to describe that argument from the start to where they are now. And then he will ask them to come together and talk about it. So you can see, so it's a post-mortem on the conflict. And this is what he says is likely to happen. Conflict starts with complaint or criticism. Okay. I'm not happy about this. Or you screwed it up again, you forgot to get the bran flakes, you know, whatever it is. Somebody's got a complaint, somebody's being critical, and the other person typically gets defensive. I am not. Why do you talk to me that way? And often it becomes reciprocal. There's high degree of reciprocity. Both people are now complaining, and both people are being defensive. Sometimes it's just one. Sometimes it's both people. So they alternate between defending themselves with the shield and denying what the other person has said and counterattacking with some kind of criticism of the other person. If that goes on long enough, then you move to the next step, which is being contemptuous of each other. When you start calling each other names that hurt, and you start doing it with a sneer on your face, that's contempt. You are so wrong. You just fucking don't get it. You are so dumb. You couldn't tie your shoelaces if you didn't have three arms. You're so, you know, okay, you know what contempt is, and I sound like I am well practiced. Oh, okay, we won't go there. And once you start to get contemptuous of the other person, there's really no defense except to be counter-contemptuous, and that really puts you in the pits. And what happens then typically is that one person begins to stonewall. I'll see you next year. Yeah, I'm out of here. I'm not going to hear you. Or start to read the paper again. Yeah. I'm not going to answer you. Don't talk to me. Yeah. I'm going to the basement. Yeah. Going to the garage. Going to the kitchen. Don't follow me. And you put up the stone wall which says, I'm not going to respond to you anymore. You are beneath my notice. And when that happens, when one person or both stonewall, you can't resolve anything. You buy time, and eventually, maybe, you'll come back to it. But for most couples, what happens when you hit the stonewall is that it comes up again, not as a, gee, I think we ought to talk about what happened last month since we haven't talked since then. We live in the same house and sleep in the same bed, but I don't want to keep this up, so let's see if we can resolve this. That's positive, but what unstable and hostile couples do is they wait until there's a new complaint or the same old complaint, and they put it out there again, and they go through the same thing. They go through the same process. When they become contemptuous, they are on the way out of the relationship. When you look at those couples, what Carrera and Gottman suggest is that in the first place, when you start to criticize, people start to get angry and they experience emotional flooding. And when your emotions overwhelm your ability to think rationally, you're flooded. And being criticized by a loved one, having the same thing brought up 62 times in a year, is likely to make you angry. And when your anger reaches the point where you can't deal with it anymore, or your sadness or your frustration, you become flooded, you want to cry, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up, your muscles get tense, and some couples who are unstable live with a good deal of stress because of their interpersonal relationship. And as that stress builds, it makes them more likely to become flooded. And the defense against that is stonewalling. I can't deal with this anymore. I can't think. I'm out of here. Psychologically, I'm out of here. So people stonewall. When people experience that flooding, I'm totally overwhelmed by the negativity in this relationship, either partner or both, then you begin to perceive that you have really severe problems. How did I get into this situation? Yeah. Every night we're fighting. Every weekend we have a big blow up. I'm constantly unhappy. I'm always crying. She hates me. Whatever form it takes, you're describing the problems as severe. You know, we have a real problem. But you're not working them out together, because every time you try to work them out together, typically most couples think that they can do it yourself. You know, it's like do-it-yourself brain surgery. It doesn't work. Do-it-yourself couples therapy does not work. You cannot be each other's therapist or your own. So couples keep trying to deal with it, and they use the same dysfunctional techniques to make the relationship better, and that doesn't work, which is why there are professional therapists and counselors out there, because they know how to guide the process to help you maybe get to the point where you can communicate about the problem. They figure out that they can't work it out together, so they're going to work it out individually. Okay, I can't discuss this with him, so I'm going to come to my own resolution of this. I'm going to figure out what to do about it. You're making it not a joint activity when you do that. So when couples stop engaging in the most important joint activity they have, which is communication, then they're in the process of heading out the door. They create separate lives and spend less time together. They avoid each other. And then they get lonely. And once people start feeling lonely within the marriage, then you start questioning. Okay, I'm always unhappy. We can't deal with this together. I'm better off without her, him. And I'm lonely. I don't want to do this. So they leave. This is what leads to divorce. Okay? But you can recognize that you don't want to go this step. But this is the trajectory that you see couples going down. You can stop at any point and work things out, ideally with therapy. People come to therapy here, and if it doesn't work or they don't go to therapy, then they're going to work on it themselves, because it's too painful to try to work on it together. And sometimes they go to therapy because they're lonely. And if they do that together, then they can turn this around. But if they don't, they're gone. Or they create a marriage that is miserable, and they stay lonely in it with separate lives. Some of you have grandparents, perhaps, who've done this, because they assumed it was permanent, and this is just the way marriages are. People always end up hating each other. They're wrong, but that's the justification they give. Don't believe them. Don't believe them. How do you predict early on? This is what Gottman has become famous for. Okay, I'm going to look at this couple. They're getting married next month. I'm going to look at this couple. They got married last month. I'm going to look at them, and I'm going to predict how long they'll stay together and whether or not they'll divorce. I count the comments they make about and to each other and about the relationship. What do I want? In the first place, the average couple says more negative things than positive. You don't want to be average. But the lesson is, think about what you say about and to the other person. If most of it is negative, the relationship is not going to last. And you know couples who talk negatively about each other and about the relationship. You know. And it may be playful. Oh, here's my ball and chain. Here's the woman who keeps me from having any fun. Here's the guy who, whatever. Those are all negative comments. They're negative about the person, they're negative about the relationship. And in happy couples who stay together, the positive outweigh the negative. In the couples who are going to get divorced, the negative outweigh the positive, usually by a sizable amount. The second characteristic, openness to influence. In a discussion, are you able to say, "Oh, you're probably right, I hadn't thought about it that way. Oh, you think we ought to, okay. All right, I'll try it that way." And you probably know couples who are right, it's their way or the highway, and they're not open to influence. In a couple that are going to stay together, they listen to each other. They try to understand each other. And they can be influenced. They are open to the idea that they may not have the best idea. They're open to the idea they may be wrong. They're open to the idea that their partner might have some idea that is better than theirs. And they'll work with that. The third characteristic is how you approach conflict. And Gottman has this nice distinction between soft startups and hostile startups. "You idiot! How could you possibly have forgotten the bran flakes?" That's a hostile startup. Okay. It's negative about the person and it's hostile in tone. What's a soft startup? Same issue. "She forgot the bran flakes." "Hi, love. You did the shopping. That's really great. Appreciate that. I guess I'll have eggs for breakfast this morning because I think we're out of bran flakes." It's a little indirect. It's soft. "I love you. Thanks for doing the shopping. You forgot the bran flakes again. You, for the 33rd time, went to the grocery store having made a list that you left at home." You could think of all the hostile startups in that situation. But couples who are going to stay together don't do those. They don't do hostile startups. They do the soft startup. The other person is likely to listen if you're starting with how much you love them and appreciating what they've done. And then you slip in the maybe I'll go by the store and get some bran flakes for tomorrow. And then she'll say, "Oh no, don't do that. That's all right." And then they apologize, and the conflict is resolved, and it hasn't become defensive. Hostile startups lead to what? It's a complaint, a criticism, then defensiveness, then contemptuousness, than stonewalling. So if you call me an idiot to start with, I'm not on the same page. So we're not going to communicate about this well. You start to flood me when you give me a hostile startup. In happy, stable marriages, husbands accept influence and de-escalate. They don't become defensive and they don't criticize back. And Gottman said he's looked at this in couples who are newly coupled and couples who've been married 40 or 50 years. And he said, it's just, you can teach this. And this is what he does. He's teaching people to stay married by teaching them how to avoid the things that will drive them apart and rehearse the script for a soft startup. Rehearse the script for not escalating. What happens in an escalation? You start with, "You forgot the bran flakes again." "Yeah, but you're not so perfect either." That's an escalation. Instead of what husbands, and it's the husbands that drive this system. That also surprised him. One of the things that Gottman says in some of his publications is that one of the things he's learned is that it's men who keep marriages together or break them up. He said all women complain. Doesn't matter. All women complain. And when challenged on that, that sounds negative, right? All women complain, and they complain more than men. But when you challenge him on that, he explains why. Women have more to complain about. They're married to men. Okay. That makes it okay. Buy it if you want, but that's his point. He's discovered that women are much more likely to notice things and to bring them up. Men tend to avoid conflict and to be more flooded by conflict. So it's harder to get us to deal with it. And when husbands don't escalate, and they get the, you idiot, you forgot the bran flakes. Oh, you're right. How stupid. I'll go back to the store and get it. That's de-escalating. It's just taking the conflict and saying, you're right. Yeah. And when couples do that, when the man in a couple relationship does that, they don't break up. I told you this story about the couple who haven't had a fight yet but know how they're going to resolve it. They'll break out the champagne, celebrate their first fight, and then he will say, you're right. End of conflict. You're right. So what Gottman is doing is teaching couples to say nice things to each other, to listen to what the other person is saying, and to accept the influence and not escalate. You don't have to fight. You can resolve conflicts without fighting. Having made a mistake does not mean you're an inadequate human being, even though your wife may tell you that you are. And you can learn to use soft startups. People use hard startups because they don't know soft language or because they're anticipating the conflict. They're anticipating the negative reaction the other person is going to have when I complain. So we use the best offense, best defense is a good offense strategy. So if I'm going to complain to you, if I need to resolve something with you, and I'm anxious about how we're going to do that, I'm likely to hit you with it hard, put you on the defensive, and that doesn't work. What I need to be able to do is to say, okay, we have a conflict. I'm sure we can resolve it. Let me see if I can put it in a way that's comfortable for you and trust you to help me work it out with you. And couples who can do that say, wait a minute, we need to go into conflict resolution mode here. Okay, let's write out the complaint, put it on the table. Let me think about that complaint for a few days and then I'll get back to you. And I'm not going to escalate and I'm not going to get mad that you have a complaint. We're just going to figure out if I can accept it and what I could do about it. And I don't have to get anxious about that. We'll just work it out because we have the tools to do that. What Gottman has looked at, one of the things he's looked at is what are the emotions that are important? And the basic one is that if there's no positive affect, here you go. Why bother being together and you're not going to be together very long if there is no positive affect? Anger is actually not as bad as criticism, contempt, defensiveness, or stonewalling. Anger is not as bad as the others, which is interesting because many people say, well, anger is what drives people apart. It's not. It's how you respond to the anger. And criticism, constant criticism, is a problem. Defensiveness is a problem. Contemptuousness is the worst problem. Once you start being contemptuous and putting your partner down, there's no way to respond to that in an appropriate way. Once you start being contemptuous of me, then there's really no relationship left that I want to preserve. And stonewalling doesn't get you anywhere. What's interesting is that couples differ and individuals differ in how they perceive anger, how they see positive and negative emotions generally. But cutting to the bottom line, if you see anger as neutral, okay, he's angry. So he's angry. That's neither good nor bad. It's just he's angry. And I can respond positively in response to that. Oh, honey, I'm sorry you're upset. Tell me about this. Then you stay together. When women see anger as negative, it floods them, it frightens them, they don't know what to do with it, then marriages become unstable. And Gottman stops short of saying that all men are angry. Because it's not true. Some men very rarely get angry. But anger is one of the emotions that men are most comfortable expressing because that's the only one we've been permitted to express growing up. Men can be angry, but they can't be sad or tender or any of those other things that you'd really like them to be occasionally. But it's how you see the anger. If you see it as neutral or even positive, sometimes, oh, honey, great, I'm glad you're angry. It's nice to know you're alive. You should be angry in that situation. I applaud your being angry and being able to express it. That's a positive response. Then the couple can go on from there. But when anger makes the woman afraid, she sees it as negative, then they're not going to be able to resolve the conflicts that come up in the relationship. Think about that article, review that article, bring questions about it. And Monday, we will start looking at the Galinsky book, The Six Stages of Parenthood. And you're going to read all of it. We're going to talk about the various stages. But it's a look at the couple with child. So we're going to look at what happens before they have the child and then what happens when the child comes on Monday.